This episode of Design by Architectural Record is sponsored by Vitro Architectural Glass. Market research indicates that the installed cost of glass and metal curtain wall averages $90 per square foot nationally. But what if you could upgrade clarity, color fidelity, and energy performance for just $1 or $2 more per square foot? With SolarBand Acuity Glass by Vitro Architectural Glass, you can design ambitious facades and actually realize it on a budget and on time. Learn more about SolarBand Acuity Glass at vitroglazing.com/acuity. That's vitroglazing.com/ACUITY.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to Designed, a podcast by Architectural Record. We appreciate you listening, and once finished, please take a moment to subscribe to the podcast, rate us, and leave a comment. If you'd like to learn more about design and see all the other great content that Architectural Record has to offer, please visit architecturalrecord.com for more information. Enjoy the show and have a wonderful day.
Hello, all you beautiful people. Welcome back to another episode of Designed by Architectural Record. I am your host, Aaron Prinz. Of course, be sure to check out architecturalrecord.com and be sure to follow the podcast on Instagram at designed.podcast for everything we have coming up, and we don't want you to miss it. This week's episode, we have Deborah Burke. She does so much. She has a firm. She's the dean of Yale, and we really go into a lot of things from, you know, her practice and how that kind of works together with the academia side and her work there at Yale. So there's a lot to take away from this episode, and I don't want to distract too much. So sit back, relax, enjoy. Here we go with Deborah Burke.
All right, Deborah Burke. I have to say, board member, James Howell Foundation, advisor, Norman Foster Foundation, founder and VIP of Design NYC, VP AIA New York, Dean School of Architecture at Yale University. I'm sorry, Deborah, I have not been completely upfront. This is actually not a podcast. It's an intervention from your free time. And I'm looking at this list and there's more and more. That's only like half the list. And I was reading it and I'm like, how does she sleep? Does she? So I wanted to start when you're talking about these, you know, you're involved in so much and you also run a very successful architecture firm. So can we just start by talking about, I guess, these sort of, we'll call them extracurricular activities that you're involved in. And, you know, there may be a young person out there that wants to get involved in the local AIA chapter, but they're like, well, how is that really going to benefit me and this sort of thing? So can we just talk about this experience of these sort of side projects you're involved in or these groups you're involved in and what that does for both your career and the profession as a whole?
Wow. It's actually a more complicated question than you might imagine, I think, because if you were to try to find the direct trajectory, like I sit on this board and 3 weeks later, I got interviewed for this job because I sat next to the person at the board meeting, does not work like that. It's sort of a complicated, woven together kind of tapestry of exposure, connections, education, seeing how various systems work. And also seeing it from both sides, like maybe you're on a volunteer committee and you're helping fundraise. And then when you're on another board, you're seeing how they fundraise and you bring those two things together. You're learning from both sides. Or you're in a group that's a kind of reading group about architecture books and you read some stuff you never would have otherwise seen. And you're like, oh, that's how Corbusier structured his yada yada. Or, you know, they sort of all weave together to expose you to much more than you would be exposed to if you just stayed home and watched Netflix. So it's worth it.
Do you find there's a direct benefit to your firm or to the school that you're obviously very influential at Yale. So is there a direct benefit from these sort of things?
I think, again, the answer is the same. It's hard to say here is the direct benefit. You know, I had breakfast with this famous person, and by dinner time, his people had called me, you know, it doesn't work like that. But I think the more exposure you have, the more you learn. And as you get older and boring and have white hair like I do, you hopefully can teach other people too in these various interactions and intersections of your lives. So yes, it's good for the practice. Yes, it's good for Yale. Yes, it's good for me because it's kind of fun and interesting. And I hate not having something to do.
Obviously. So you brought up your practice and we're going to dive right into that. But I was, you know, as I was preparing for this interview, I was looking at your website and I was actually really surprised because you're like a 115th interview or something we've done. And I find that practices typically, not all the time, but typically fall into, we do civic work, you know, we do institutional, we do residential. You're kind of all over the place. Like you have, you know, high-end residential houses, schools, museums, everything. So where does this typology come from and how does that differ from project to project?
I have to say, we don't really like the description. We're kind of all over the place. Oh. That is not a good sales pitch.
I thought it was a technical term. I'm sorry. Yeah.
The breadth of our experience.
Oh, there we go. You see, that's why you're in New York City.
The breadth of our experience is pretty broad. That was not good English. You know, so we do hospitality, particularly hotels. We do institutional work, particularly universities and arts organizations. We do residential, both developer residential and custom high-end residential. Where do they overlap and where do they inform each other? Always for good, interesting people you can learn from, kind of back to your first question to me. Almost always in some ways involved with the arts. And as often as possible from our perspective, also involved with communities. So it could be a community arts center in New Haven or a community arts center in New York or a hotel that has public art in the lobby that people come into. They do inform each other. When we do houses, we rely on some of our hotel experience. When we do hotels, we rely on our residential experience. You know, definitions, I think, of how we live and how we work and how we relax are blurring, particularly since COVID, but even well before COVID. And so I think the siloed approach to defining a practice doesn't make any sense anymore.
And I think this is also a good time to jump in. Your adaptive reuse projects, I've heard you speak on this before, and I find you have a very interesting approach to just how you perceive what adaptive reuse is. Well, I think this is an interesting point to bring up because, and one project that really caught my eye was the Next Haven Art and Community Incubator. And I think it was a really interesting, so it's a developing neighborhood it's a developing neighborhood. And it's really the center for the arts and beacon that's right in the center of it. So can you take us through the design process of this project? What were the goals? What were the outcomes? And just overall, just take us through it.
Thank you. Next Haven is an absolutely fantastic, complicated, interesting, forward-looking project, first and foremost. And that's not about us. That's about Titus Kaphar, the now well-known African-American artist who started it as a place where, as an artist residency center. So you get a fellowship, you apply, you get a fellowship, you spend a year there, you get a stipend, and you have a studio space and a place to live, but you have a studio space to work in. That's the most important thing. So it gives you a chance to just do your work because, you know, most artists in whatever art form they're in, but these are primarily visual artists, you waitress, you drive a truck, you babysit, you do whatever in order to do your work. And this is really, we're giving you a stipend and we're giving you a place to live and we're giving you a place to work because you're an artist and you need to do your work. And we will have other things going on. We will educate you about how the art world works. We will employ kids from the local high school and pay them and they work for you and with you so that they learn that art is a possible career. We have public spaces in the building where the community feels welcome. It is a disadvantaged neighborhood, only about a mile from Yale, but a world apart from Yale in New Haven. And it has been, even with COVID, an extraordinary success. Now, where does architecture come in? So Titus worked with the city of New Haven and they essentially gave him, in effect, two abandoned one-story brick buildings. One had been a factory for making the glass tubes that chemists use, and the other, they had made ice cream. Very cool factory. And they were separated by a gap, and they had an empty lot behind them. So we renovated the buildings and built new buildings in between them in order to meet the program and send the message. So building has a big glass front, not a pull-down gate. It doesn't say we're terrified. It says, come on in and look at the art and meet some of the artists or come to this. They set up a vaccine center there during COVID. They set up a food pantry there before Thanksgiving. The goal is to, one, that artists can do serious work. Curators can do serious work. The gallery gets visitors from all over the place. And also, the community feels welcome to experience the art and meet artists. And the role of the architecture was to make all of those things possible. So that's what we did. It was fun.
Well, I want to, you know, towards the last part you got in there, and I, you know, going through school, I'm very early in my career in terms of actually professionally practicing. But this comes up a lot in school about, you know, this disadvantaged neighborhood. Can we talk about, the struggle I have with it personally is a lot of times it's someone from outside the neighborhood kind of assigning what they feel the need is to the neighborhood. Can you talk a little bit about the community engagement in that process and how you really factored in, you know, you're talking about, oh, we want it to be a place for the neighborhood to go. What was the process of defining what that was and how successful do you think it was implemented?
Titus and Jason Price's partner in the project took the lead on that, met with community leaders, met with people at the high school, and made good on their promise. You know, we're not doing this to gentrify this neighborhood. We are doing this because we feel we belong here, and decidedly we are not part of Yale. You know, we are, this is, artists need to be in the community. But I would say in all of our projects, the Women's Building, which unfortunately did not get built, but was an adaptive reuse project to take what had been a women's prison and turn it into a center for foundations and NGOs that work on women and girls issues around the world. That was based in New York City. 122 CC, which is an old New York public school that's now an art center. In every one of those, you go out in the community and you listen. You listen and you listen and you listen. You take notes. You can't necessarily meet everybody's dreams and demands, but they need to be heard so that you're not the sort of arrogant architect striding in there and saying, and here is what I'm doing, you say for you, and they hear to us, and that's really bad. It's more, what are we doing together to make life better for everybody?
So it's, I find this an interesting question that comes up on the podcast a lot, but when you look at a project, and I could tell your ears kind of perked up when I brought in Next Haven. And so when you have a really successful project, it's so easy to be like, man, killed it, crushed it. If you were to go back now, it's all built, what would you do a little differently maybe?
At Next Haven?
Yeah.
I think at Next Haven, I would have paid more attention to I don't want to say the exterior as in what the building looks like. Building looks really cool. Both the old parts that have been fixed up and the new parts that we inserted that look very new. But the landscape, and I don't mean like bushes sort of parsley around the Thanksgiving turkey deal, but one of the things COVID brought home to us all, I believe, was the need to be outside and how we could actually, you know, we were eating dinner outside in New York City when it was 40 degrees. It was like, oh, who knew we could do this? So what the outside is like, how you step outside with a cup of coffee with the artist in the studio next to you, and you don't want to be in your space or their space. You actually just want to talk about some ideas. I wish now, in hindsight, we had paid more attention to the interior-exterior interrelationship and taken better advantage of outdoor usable space opportunities. How does that sound? But that's honest. I mean, that's really when I go there now and I stand outside with somebody from Next Haven to talk about X or Y or Z, it's like, damn, you know, we should have done this a little better.
So I want to kind of switch gears here a little bit because you are the dean of the School of Architecture at Yale University. Fancy. I was bringing this up. It was like early on in the podcast, all my people were from like these type of schools. And I would always be like, it's like Narnia from where I grew up in like small, you know, podunk Northern California, Red Bluff. And I'd be like, no one actually goes there. They're not real places, but you're there a lot. But you also run a successful firm. So when you're surrounded by, because academia to me is so like, it's this balance of hypothetical and pragmatic to a certain extent where there's some, you know, when you're in the real world, gravity does exist and that form might not exactly function how it needs to be. And that roof needs to be a little bit thicker and these sort of things that we all see in school. So, but being in that world and then running a firm, how do these two, does one influence the other? And do you see direct relationships in the work that your firm produces
that are a result of you being in this environment?
Yikes, complicated.
That's very, very long
question. Braided together kind of question.
You should see the reviews. People call me out on them all the time.
I guess, yes, inevitably, that one influences the other, because every week I work, I work like 50, 60 hour a week, roughly half and half. So yes, they influence each other. When I'm both have a lot to do with expectation management, reality, experience management, aesthetic decision-making, personal decision-making and advice. So running a school and running a practice, whatever they are, you could ask the same question, I guess, of the dean of a medical school or the dean of a law school, right? It's like, what's the relationship between what you're teaching and what you're doing when you're actually doing what it is you do, like being an architect? Different schools of architecture focus on different things. And Yale has always been a place where the dean is a practitioner as opposed to a scholar or a theorist or a professional educator. And Yale has always been a place where they have this project in the first year for the graduate students called the Building Project, where the students design a building and then actually build it collectively with their hands, with saws and hammers and nails. And since I've been dean, we've been building tiny little houses for an organization called Columbus House, which offers services to the homeless community in New Haven. So I would say our students at Yale get great history, of course, great theory. They get all the stuff they have to learn to become architects, but they also get a lot of hands-on experience. Like, when you put two pieces of wood together, this is how they go together. So when they're drawing a building that they're designing, they are aware of a kind of, I guess, let's call it a material reality. Like, to actually build a building, you have to obey the laws of physics, the laws of chemistry, the laws of gravity, and the zoning code and the building code. They're kind of aware, they are aware of that because we weave it into our curriculum.
In Yale, the whole grad school process, I found it very stressful because you're filling out these applications, you try to get your portfolio the best you can, and you just send it out to the universe, and then you get a hard no or a hard yes. And you don't really, there's no really like, what did I do wrong? How could I do better? But from obviously a very well-respected institution, what are you looking for in students that are coming into your school?
We are looking for people who can think and create on their own. We are not looking for people who copy. We're distinctly wary of plagiarism. Because nowadays that is so easy,
you brought this up. We're going to get into it, but keep going. This is my big pet peeve about architecture, but go ahead, continue.
So that's what we're looking for. We're looking for creative potential and somebody with their own voice, and they can express it to us. They express it to us in their portfolio. They express it to us in their writing, in the little statement they have to make. And we wade through literally thousands, of applicants to find people who we feel have what we're looking for. Not all of them studied architecture as undergrads. A lot of them, art history, biology, not so many biologists, but you get the idea. People do come from all over and they decide they want to be architects. But so what we are looking for is an expression of creativity and individual thinking.
I saw authenticity is listed on your website. And what I really respect when I was, flipping through the projects on your website is there's quotes from other partners on your website. It's like, it's Deborah Burke Partners, but it's not every quote is from you about the project. And I find that's a compliment.
My partners are smarter than I am. So it was a good idea to quote them.
But you brought up this copying, and this has been the biggest pet peeve of mine because I brought this up numerous times on the podcast before, but I come from the world of stand-up comedy, where if you say something that is remotely similar to what someone has, you might not work again. But in the realm of architecture, it is like second nature that you look at a precedent and you look at six precedents, and then young architects have a building that looks like six buildings that are merged together. And so, I don't know if you could just elaborate on this sort of notion of authenticity.
Well, they need an editor, clearly.
But you see this a lot in young architects' work and even young practices. You can see it, like just this regurgitation of a bad version of a Zaha or a bad version of XYZ architect, doesn't matter. So can you just elaborate a little bit on this notion of authenticity?
So, I think it's interesting that you talk about comedy, or but it could be writing a sonnet, could be writing a song. We all learn from precedent. It's not as though you're inventing a new way for things as an architect to stand up, because as you pointed out, all buildings do have to deal with gravity. I think in school, let's start out with in school, you learn to acknowledge your precedent, your inspiration. You say, I was inspired by Mies van der Rohe's, you know, Barcelona Pavilion, and I too am using large expanses of stone walls. Here's what I'm doing differently, or here's what I got from the inspiration, because I'm not building in Barcelona, I'm building in the 21st century. So here's what I have done differently. So step one is you acknowledge the way, if you were writing somebody something, you would quote somebody and say their name, you know, that's what you do. I think when you're out in the real world and you're starting to practice, you will head in a certain direction. Like you can look at a house and say, that's Victorian. So a lot of people were doing the same kind of thing, let's say in San Francisco, which you said, a place you said you lived. So there are styles and trends, but within them, you still need your own voice. And it takes time to develop that. You know, if you're writing sonnets, your first few sonnets probably aren't Shakespearean, but you get better at it, but it still takes the form of a sonnet, you know? So for a building, as you do more and more, and buildings get built very slowly and cost a lot of money, so it takes a lot of time to get this experience, but as you do it more and more, you develop your own voice, you get better at it. They all still have to keep the rain out, you know? It's so there are certain requirements in effect, and then certain, and many, many, many opportunities for creativity, and over time you develop your voice. When I talk about plagiarism, and I mean real plagiarism, and it's rampant in schools today, you know, students will take whole paragraphs out of Wikipedia and stick it into an essay.
At least they're using a trusted source.
There you go. I'm kidding. Deeply researched, you know, never mind. I won't even go there. there is software, of course, that can find that kind of plagiarism. And it's very easy to define what plagiarism is in writing. It's a lot harder if you do a deep dive into the bowels of what's available on the magic internet and pick drawings from old projects and, you know, and mush them all together in a collage of images that is blinding and confusing. And it looks like you're creative, but really you've just, you know, like gone through a garbage dump and glued stuff together. That drives me insane, because so much of a better use of the students' time would have been to create rather than to hunt. We don't have software quite yet that can find that plagiarized work.
Well, you brought up trends in architecture. What do you think, you know, trends come and go, and what do you think the world of architecture needs more of, and what do you think that maybe we've had enough of?
The world of architecture and the world of building in general needs to pay a whole lot more attention to its carbon footprint. I know that even those words sound so overused these days, but buildings in general, not just ones that, you know, are prefaced by a capital A architecture, have a giant global carbon footprint in terms of their construction, their maintenance, their fueling, their heating, their cooling, et cetera. So new buildings need to be more responsible to the environment, let's put it that way, and sort of aware of how they are in a shared community, right? Equally accessible to all. What should there be less of?
Feel free to name names too. It's okay.
Oh, no, I would never do that.
As we go back at AIA,
I have to be friends with everybody in order that they would come and, you know, give a lecture at Yale.
I'm teasing, but.
What should there be less of? I think, I'm not going to say extravagance, because, you know, everybody likes a little bit of extravagance. I would say extravagance without value. This sort of Trumpian swagger that has no substance behind it, you know, gold leaf on thin air. So that's it. I'd like, so it's not a style other than Shazam Bang. There should be no more Shazam Bang buildings.
Awesome.
That's a term we're going to write down. That's going to be the title of this episode. Shazam bang right there with Deborah Burke. So I'm asking you, I want to switch gears to kind of the profession as a whole. And I'm asking you this question not as anything to do with your firm, but because you are in contact with, I think, people that go on typically to very large and successful firms. There's been a push lately, I'm sure you've seen in the news, for, say, more representation of the young architect. What do you think about this whole move to kind of push for more representation among younger architects?
So as we were talking about a little earlier in this conversation, it takes a long time to learn how to build a building, right? It's complicated, it's expensive, it moves slowly. So I do believe in all firms, credit to everybody who played a role, not the sole supposed genius at the top of the pyramid, but everybody plays a role. That should be acknowledged. People who are learning, it needs to be ensured that they actually are learning, you know, that they're not just doing rote repetitive activities, but that there is, you know, they're headed toward a kind of overall expertise. And, you know, people need to be paid for their work. Maybe the most important thing, people need to be paid for their work and paid fairly for their work. And one could say about architecture, you know, with the exception of a few very, very kind of globally successful architects, architecture on the whole is not a highly compensated field. That's a shame because buildings last for a long time and have an enormous impact on communities. Architects should be paid more. But within a firm, you know, to the extent that the finances allow, people should be paid fairly. And when I say to the extent that the finances allow.
No, I think it's a complicated topic. And I bring this up. It came up, it was like episode 13. Alvin Wong, Synthesis DNA out in Los Angeles, used to work for Zaha. And he said, I worked for Zaha for 3.5 years. And for fun, when I quit, I added up all the hours I worked on my time cards. And I worked the equivalent of 7.5 years. So he worked
in averaging
80 something hours per week. And I do think this is just my sort of interpretation of it going through 7 years of architecture school, is that there is somewhat of an indoctrination from year one of architecture school that kind of sets this expectation of, if you're not here on the weekend, you're not really into architecture school. If you're not here overnight, you're not really trying. There's this sort of thing. And also with that regard, that architecture can solve every problem in the history of the world. I just think it's fundamentally
It's not true. It's not curing cancer. And it's,
but you see all of these sort of things from year one in architecture school. So when you get a job, it's expected. I don't know. I mean, my wife is in HR. We're not sitting here talking about medical benefits on a Sunday afternoon. You know what I mean? So it's like there's a. Hold on, I'm gathering my thoughts. There's a persistence to the profession.
I'm interrupting you a little bit, but
yes.
The students at Yale will tell you that I walk through this, well, when the studios are open, and we're open now, but I walk through the studios at night and I say to people, go home. And I joke with people, get outside, get some exercise, take a shower, make sure you sleep, go across the street, there's great theater, go across the street, there's an incredible museum. Go 3 blocks away. The music school has free concerts at lunchtime, because the best architects are not only, you know, well-rested and healthy, they're also culturally literate. They know what else is going on in the world. And I think this, look, I said at the beginning, I work hard, but I also get exercise every day. I go to the theater, I read, because it's false that an 80-hour week is better for you or better for architecture. It's not.
I think it's also important to notice, I could understand if you're drawing stuff by hand and you have to scrap a drawing and start, but in the last 30 years, the architecture technology, your productivity is much higher than it was in the 70s and 80s, and yet the expectation of hours has remained relatively flat. Would you agree with that, or am I way off base here?
No, I think the connection to studio culture in school, maybe it's not unlike competitive sports. You know, I worked out for 10 hours, you worked out for 15 hours and you win. You know, it's not just the faculty it's a competitive environment of who's working the hardest on studio, right? Because it's only about studio. And then you get to a firm, and unless the leadership is pretty adamantly, consistently clear, those habits follow into practice. But I don't think they have to. In fact, they shouldn't. And they shouldn't happen in school either, but it takes, I don't know if you ever read Danny Meyer's book, Setting the Table, his story about how he decided not to go to law school and he opened a restaurant. And of course, now he's an extraordinarily successful restaurateur. Everybody knows who he is. And there's a Shake Shack in every airport in America. But in this book, somebody, he describes, you know, you go into a Danny Meyer restaurant and everybody is nice to you and gracious and helpful and the food is delicious. Somebody asked him, how does he get his staff to be that way? And he described it as constant, gentle pressure. And I thought those were such the most important, the two most important words are constant and gentle, and they go together. It's like, you know, salt and pepper goes in the middle of the table. Salt and pepper goes in the middle of the table. Salt and pepper goes in the middle of the table. And at an office, I think it has to be, you know what? It's getting on 7 o'clock. You really should go home. Or you know what? You came in at 6 this morning. That's crazy. Go for a run before you come to work. It's like, but it's like again and again and again, you need to remind people that you're concerned about the quality of their work, not the quantity of hours they put in.
What's your proudest moment in architecture?
In architecture, my proudest moment? Damn, you know what it's like in architecture? Every time you get a job, it's like, awesome, this is my most proudest moment ever. I got a new project. And then it finishes, the building's done, the owner and client are happy, you're happy, your team is happy, you walk around the outside of your building and it's like, oh, this is my proudest moment ever, this is the best building ever. Then you wake up the next morning, you're like, oh my God, now I gotta start again. So I think proudest moment occurs again and again and again and again.
You know, looking back at your career, kind of on the opposite side of that, what was the biggest setback you've had in your career? And how have you kind of used that to motivate yourself to get to where you are now?
Wow, my biggest setback. I did not prepare for this question.
We save all the good questions for the end. So. It's all filler until we get to this point, Deborah.
You know, I think it's a little bit like proudest moment. You wake up, or I wake up most mornings thinking, oof, what can I do a little bit better today that I didn't do so well at yesterday? So every day there's some kind of setback, and it's a good tool for self-flagellation, which I am excellent at. No single, I mean, to me, both of these questions are actually deeply personal ones. Like, I'm in a happy 30-year marriage. I have a beautiful child. My greatest joy, of course, is being a mother. I come from a close-knit family. Biggest setbacks are personal too. They're when people you love who made your life possible die. So in the world of architecture, it's just keep on working, find all the joyful satisfaction you can, incorporate the setbacks so the thing you do next is better. But I don't see architecture in those terms. I see personal things as worthy of pride and reflection on setbacks.
Knowing what you know now, you've had this amazing career. We went over some of the accolades, you know, previously in this conversation, but knowing what you know now, what would you tell 20-year-old Deborah sitting at, you know, her studio desk, RISD, and knowing what you know now, what advice would you have?
Wow. Push your ideas harder and always be better prepared than you thought you could be.
Last question. What's next for Deborah Burke, and what's next for Deborah Burke Partners?
Ooh, more things that'll make us proud. New buildings that we get hired to do and then get finished and we walk around them in joyful, gleeful bliss. You know, architects say they're never going to retire. I guess that's what architects say. But I am going to continue to look for that joyful bliss of making buildings until I just can't do it anymore.
Well, Deborah, this has been an awesome 40 minutes. I really enjoyed it. I think your audience will too, and I hope you did. And thanks a lot.
Yeah, it was fun. Yeah. It was good fun.
Enjoy, everybody.
Thank you for listening to an episode of Designed, a podcast by Architectural Record. If you enjoyed this episode, we would appreciate you taking a moment to subscribe to the podcast, give us a rating, and leave us a comment. Have a wonderful day.